This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can tell by the title of his new book, The End of Oil, that journalist Paul Roberts is confident big change is on the horizon, like it or not. He writes, "Each year it is more and more evident that the extraordinary machine we have built to supply the demand for oil cannot sustain itself in its present form. Not a day goes by without some new disclosure, some new bit of headline evidence that our brilliant energy success comes at great cost. Air pollution and toxic waste sites, blackouts and price spikes, fraud and corruption, and even war." In his new book, he tells the story of how we got into this predicament and what some of the options are for our energy future. At the beginning of his book, Roberts confesses he's lost his faith in the modern energy economy. I asked him how he lost it.
The moment that I had in the desert in Saudi Arabia where I heard, you know, Saudi oil engineers admit that the biggest oil field in the world, Ghawar, was in decline, was filling with water, which is a sign that its years are kind of coming to a close. You know, that was a kind of a hair-raising moment for anyone who's looked at energy and oil. This is the mother of all fields. It's the one that's supplied a huge portion of the world's oil supply, and to have it showing its age, showing gray hairs, was kind of frightening. But I think that more generally, we all have a sense, most of us have a sense, that we can continue to go to the gas station and fill up. And if prices rise in the summer, you know, the price for gasoline, it'll come back down in the fall, and everything's cyclical and seasonal. And we really don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about it because, you know, the market will solve problems. It will see the challenges, and it will come up with new technologies, you know, new ways to get more oil or new ways to burn fuel more cleanly. And that, you know, that's fine. And I think that what becomes clear after you spend some time looking at the evolution of the energy industry and some of the challenges that it faces is you realize that the market isn't going to be able to do this by itself, you know, and that the system's sort of in a slow motion collapse.
Your book is called The End of Oil. Different experts have different thoughts about this, but what are some of the answers you've heard to the question, how close are we till we have really depleted the oil resources of the world?
Well, it's kind of a complex question, but the simple answer is that in about 10 years, I think within 10 years, we're going to see definite signs that, you know, the cheap oil, the easy oil, the oil that flows out of the ground and that we've been, you know, using for the last 100 years is going to start becoming scarcer.
But I thought that there were new places being tapped in parts of Africa and Central Asia. In former Soviet republics, aren't those adding new options for us for gas, for oil?
Well, they are. Mm-hmm. They are. And if you just looked at the headlines, you'd get this incredible sense of optimism that, you know, we don't need to rely on the Middle East anymore because we are finding oil in Angola and Nigeria and Russia, that, you know, there's Venezuela, there's Canada and Mexico, and there's all these, you know, the Kazakhstan, there's all these alternatives to the Middle East. But although there's a great deal of oil in these places, you know, there are kind of two constraints there. One is that you probably have noticed that these places happen to have politically unstable, really nasty regimes that make it, in many cases, and it makes it tough for the U.S. to have some sort of a relationship with these countries that isn't somehow compromised by our need to get their oil. That's the first constraint. The second constraint is that even though the oil is flowing out of these countries right now, these guys don't have the oil reserves that the Middle Eastern countries do. They just don't. I mean, no matter how people talk about Russia as the new oil frontier or the bonanza in West Africa, I mean, it's small potatoes compared with the Saudis. And so sooner or later, you know, we're going to be back in the Middle East.
Paul, since you've been so immersed in the geopolitics of oil, how much do you think oil figures into the real reasons for the war in Iraq?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to be debating that for decades. But I think it's fair to say that although no nation goes to war for one single reason, that it's complex in any case, no less so in Iraq, that despite whatever the administration actually thought about weapons of mass destruction or the links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, oil was certainly on their radar screen. I mean, the fact of the matter is that America uses a great deal of oil. One of every 4 barrels produced on the planet is used here. Our trading partners like Europe and Japan rely on the Middle East. So what happens in the Middle East? Anything that threatens the stability of the Middle East and its capacity to keep supplying oil reliably and smoothly is deeply important to us. And the fact that Saddam Hussein was increasingly threatening the stability of the region in the view of the White House was, reason enough to be very concerned that, anything else, all we needed to find was one other reason, I think, and it was time to go in.
So you're saying that the reason wasn't literally that oil figures into the war, not necessarily literally to get the oil in Iraq, but to keep the region stable so that we could get oil from the larger region. Is that what you're suggesting?
Iraq was seen as the key by a lot of people as a way to do a couple things. If we could liberate Iraq from Saddam Hussein and build Iraq's oil industry back up to its not only its former glory but its potential. It's got a huge amount of oil. I mean, the second largest reserves in the world, right behind Saudi Arabia, and it's being underutilized, to use the term of art. So if we could build that industry back up, and further, if we could convince the Iraqis to leave OPEC, to no longer side with their neighboring countries in setting oil policy, then we could flood the market with cheap oil. We could drive the price down, and that would do two things. It would deprive OPEC of their pricing power. I mean, they've had 30 years of essentially strangling our economy by being able to blackmail us with whatever price they wanted. So that would be off the table. We'd be able to deprive Arab countries of a huge source of revenue, some of which had been used to fund terrorism. And so for a lot of members of the Bush administration, certainly going back before the Bush administration, that was a win-win. I mean, that penciled out beautifully on paper.
My guest is Paul Roberts, and he's the author of the new book, The End of Oil. The United States has had a special relationship with Saudi Arabia, and the Bush family, seems to particularly have close ties with Saudi Arabia and with the Saudi leadership. I don't know if you read Bob Woodward's book or not, but one of the most quoted passages of the book, as I'm sure you know, has to do with Saudi Arabia having made promises to President Bush to keep the price of oil low before the coming presidential election. When you read that or heard that, what was your interpretation of it?
Well, I think it's entirely possible that the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. made the promise. The Saudis have a history of doing just that, two things, of saying what they think the U.S. wants to hear. But there's also a history of helping us out in the oil world. And so, it may be that the Saudis actually believed at that time when the promise was made that it would be in their interest to keep prices down. But the evidence today, what's going on today paints a picture that's completely opposite that. The Saudis have done pretty much everything they can to keep the price of oil high. And, right now we're oil selling at about $39 a barrel, and future prices are also high. And the Saudis are making no effort to raise production. That is, they're not trying to add to the oil supply and thereby bring the price down. They're saying the price is fine. It'll fall of its own accord. And, the Bush administration promised that if oil prices were high, they would jawbone OPEC. They would lean on the Saudis. And there's no evidence that they're doing that. And the question, it may be that the Bush administration is so pleased with the Saudi cooperation in the war on terror and so pleased with the Saudi efforts to control the money laundering that was such a problem in the 1990s that they're going to leave the Saudis alone on oil. But my sense is that the administration feels completely unable to control the situation, that they just don't have the kind of leverage that they thought they did with the Saudis. And from the Saudi side, they're in a really tough spot. They don't like angering the Americans, or most of the leadership in the House of Saud doesn't like angering the Americans. And the Americans have not only protected them from, Saddam Hussein, but they've been a huge customer. The U.S. market is the market, the oil market that you want to be in. It's not only the biggest in the world, but it's one of the fastest growing. So you can't afford to miss out on it. And further, we've sold them weapons. We've helped them out in any number of ways. And so it's not in their interest in the long term to make us angry. That said, the Saudis are now dealing with an internal situation. It's much different than it was, say, 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, right after the first Gulf War, you could walk down the street in Riyadh and you could see posters of American soldiers. I mean, we were heroes. Now, you know, you don't see that at all. You know, no Saudi official wants to make any show of being pro-American, because that's just really unpopular right now. And so the Saudis don't want to appear to be sucking up to us, you know. They don't want to appear to be helping out the administration of George Bush. So it may be that the Saudis, you know, come the fall, right before the election, they are going to start pumping oil like mad and bring the price down and thus help, you know, George Bush float to victory on an ocean of cheap oil. But I can't think of anything that would look more suspect than something like that happening.
My guest is Paul Roberts, author of the new book, The End of Oil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Paul Roberts. His new book is called The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. In April 2001, Vice President Cheney, who headed the president's energy task force, said that environmentalists wanted the government to, quote, step in and force Americans to consume less energy, as if we could simply conserve or ration our way out of the situation we're in. He also said conservation might, quote, be a sign of personal virtue, but is not a sufficient basis for a sound, comprehensive energy policy, unquote. Do you think the Bush administration's interest in conservation, that their emphasis in conservation has changed at all since September 11th?
I'm sure it probably has. I mean, you know, they came in swinging. They were going to fix all the problems that had been allowed to fester by a certain unnamed, you know, Democratic administration, who had essentially allowed the country's ability to supply itself with energy to fail. You know, we were going to drill more oil wells. We were going to build more refineries, more power plants, more natural gas pipelines. And we were going to make America again a nation that produces the energy that it needs. I think since then, they have to have come to the conclusion that there's going to have to be some focus on demand, on reducing demand, or at least controlling demand. There was some talk about making SUVs more fuel efficient, maybe getting them to be a mile and a half, you know, more, you get a mile and a half more per gallon. But I mean, that's ridiculous. That's statistically, that's irrelevant. And the administration knows it. They're still not focusing on conservation, although they're probably much less willing to come out and say so.
President Bush advocates funding for research into hydrogen fuel cells, which could possibly power automobiles as an alternative to gas. What is the outlook for hydrogen fuel cells as an energy alternative?
Well, hydrogen has attracted a lot of attention because it's got such a great, it has such great potential. And the administration certainly played the hydrogen card really effectively. They've said, look, let's not go overboard trying to save oil right now, because the future is hydrogen. We're going to invest in hydrogen. We're going to build these cars that are clean. They burn hydrogen. They admit there's no emissions other than steam, and they're really the future. And so that's what we're going to do. And there's a couple of things people need to realize. The first is that the administration has really dedicated a relatively small amount of money to developing hydrogen. You know, it's nothing compared to how much the U.S. government grants in terms of subsidies and tax breaks to the oil and gas industry. You know, it's a drop in the bucket. So if we were truly interested in building a hydrogen future, we'd be spending, you know, like $10 billion a year. And we're not. We're not even coming close. The second thing is, even if we were able to develop a hydrogen fuel cell car that was cost effective, and you have to keep in mind that right now, although they're really wonderful machines, they're super expensive. The fuel cell has still got a number of engineering hurdles that need to be crossed before people like you and me can go out and buy them. Now, let's say, however, that those hurdles had been passed and that we had fuel cell cars that were competitive, cost competitive with cars that we have right now. Where are you going to get the fuel? You still have to build this massive hydrogen fueling infrastructure. You know, you have to have refineries, you have to have pipelines, you have to have special trucks. You know, hydrogen is this extremely tricky material, you know, fuel to handle. You have to basically compress it or freeze it to turn it into a liquid. And essentially, you know, you're going to have to come up with some way to dispense it in a service station that someone like you or I could do without killing ourselves. You know, so there's that whole process that hasn't, I mean, people are looking at it. A lot of smart people are looking exactly how to do that, but it's going to be challenging technically. It's going to be super expensive to go ahead and refit enough service stations to have hydrogen. You know, they figure you need at least one in three. That was the lesson we learned from the diesel, you know, having diesel cars on the road, was that you needed to have at least one in three or at minimum one in four service stations selling diesel before consumers felt comfortable enough, you know, buying a diesel vehicle. So you're going to need something like that for hydrogen as well.
What about automobile makers? Do you think that the automakers would like to invest in hydrogen fuel cells as an alternative?
Well, they are. They are. They went crazy in the 90s. They saw, I mean, for decades, they just poo-pooed hydrogen. They thought it would never happen. Then you had a company in Vancouver, British Columbia, Ballard Power, make some incredible advances in shrinking the fuel cell, which had been these gigantic, bulky, heavy things, making it small enough to put into a car and then really working to bring the cost down. When that happened, you know, Detroit said, whoa, you know, we're falling behind here. We're going to get blown away once again. And they started investing substantially. Toyota, General Motors, Ford, all of them began investing in various ways. But although the fuel cell research is moving ahead and although advances are being made, there are still these obstacles that are really frightening to a car industry that's already having enough trouble making a buck even with gasoline-powered cars. You know, as far as they're concerned, the future is hybrids.
Have you driven one?
Not yet. I'm still waiting. There's still quite a line, a waiting list to get the Toyota Prius, which is a problem. I mean, you know, just as people are starting to get excited about these hybrids, it's hard to get them. And I think people are looking at that. They're saying, well, it's going to be hard to buy them. What about the repair? I mean, you know, if my Prius breaks down and I take it to my local shop and the guy's never seen anything like it before, what am I supposed to do? But that said, these are fairly small engineering challenges. And in the long term, you can apply this hybrid technology to just about anything. You know, you can apply it to not only just these small cars, but SUVs. I mean, Ford just bought Toyota's hybrid technology. And that's huge. I mean, you know, we're beginning to see the possibility that Americans can have their cake and eat it too, at least in terms of cars.
Do you think that most experts have given up on solar power and wind power as being good alternative sources of energy?
No. A lot of the U.S. has given up on those. But in Europe, I mean, wind is huge. It's just if you go to Europe in the past 5 years, and you take one of the high-speed trains and go out the countryside, and it's just wind farms everywhere. And, you know, they are serious about it. They have a little strong government support. And they subsidize their wind farmers, and they made it a law that utilities have to buy power from wind farmers. So they've really created this network that's very supportive of the wind farm. In Japan, they are going crazy with solar. You know, they have they're making huge advances in the efficiency of these solar panels. They're subsidizing homeowners to put them on their roofs. You know, they're building up this market. They know that it's not cost effective now, but if you begin, you know, scaling up your solar base, costs will come down and people will begin, it will be cost competitive. So those are two examples of where solar, you know, where alternative energies are working. But what's important to keep in mind is these were both areas that the U.S. had dominance in at some point in its own history and has essentially surrendered it. You know, the Japanese now dominate solar, Europe dominates the wind, and the U.S. is kind of sitting back and going, well, you know, we'll buy that if it makes sense. We'll buy that if the market tells us we should buy it. And although wind is really picking up here in the U.S., it's slow and it's not moving in a comprehensive way. It's not moving as part of a national strategy. It's simply moving into markets where it makes sense, you know, in small areas. And that's, although that's a good start, and it's important for people to begin to see that wind can work, it really should be part of a national strategy that asks, where do we want to be in 20 years from now or 30 years from now? And what kind of energy do we want to be using? And how is that going to fit into any sort of a climate policy? And taking all that into account and saying, okay, now what part of that strategy can wind take care of? What part can solar? And where else? And then what other kinds of technologies do we need to start developing? How do we target our investment dollars, our research dollars?
If countries succeed in moving away from an oil economy, either because they want to or because they have no choice, what changes? I mean, do you see the whole world order changing when that happens? And so much of the world revolves around oil right now.
Well, it depends how quickly that happens. I mean, if there are essentially two scenarios to moving to a post-oil order. The first is the real nasty one. That's where a country like Saudi Arabia or Venezuela falls into civil war. And all of a sudden you have, in the case of Saudi Arabia, 8 million barrels of oil of daily production taken off the market. And it's chaos, it's oil price spikes, it's recession, and we're forced to cut back our oil use and to rapidly develop alternatives, which means you'd get the quickest energy source you could, which in this country would be coal. And that would be disastrous for our efforts to keep climate from changing. So that's the bad scenario. The good scenario is that you gradually move from an oil-dominated economy to something else. And maybe today's high prices are the kind of thing that helps you move gradually. I mean, when prices get high like this, economies are magnificent at adapting. We begin looking for – we use less oil. We begin looking at alternatives. And if oil prices stayed high, like in the $35 to $40 a barrel range, which I think they're going to. I think that we should just say right now, that's my forecast is that we're going to be looking at expensive oil for at least the next 6 years. And if prices stay that high, the economy responds in ways that could be really positive. You know, we could see a lot of move away from, toward more fuel efficient cars like hybrids. You know, consumers could finally say, hey, $3 gasoline is real. We could see more investment in things like wind and solar. We could see more investment in alternative fuels, ethanol, for example, although that's got a whole set of complications that are going to slow its emergence. But that's the kind of a slow scenario that lets people adjust gradually, smoothly, without a huge amount of disruption or economic pain. And it might be that 20 years from now, we find ourselves in this new energy economy that we kind of arrived at gradually. Again, the alternative to that is the overnight disruption where we're forced to move. And if that happens, if we are forced to move quickly, our choices are so limited that we're going to choose badly.
Paul Roberts is the author of The End of Oil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.